The people who use asbestos cement siding report with satisfaction. It keeps homes snug and tight against all kinds of weather. It gives real protection against the hazards of fire. And so, we suggest you consider this material for the walls of your home. Designed to last a lifetime. A trouble-free lifetime.
Hi, you're listening to an audio documentary brought to you by the independent think tank Respublica. This is Dust to Dust. Dust to Dust has been released as part of Airtight on Asbestos, a nationwide campaign by Respublica to urge the UK government to reform its safety monitoring standards around asbestos in public buildings. In part two, we tell the story of Nellie Kershaw, whose death set a precedent for diagnosing asbestos-related illness and the culture of cover-up around its harms that lasted until the ban. It is spring, 1922, and the Rovers of Rochdale are taking their early morning walk to work. Over the ridged roofs of the Turner and Newell factory drift clouds of thick black smoke, along with the wakening judder of machines used to weave asbestos into yarn. Soon the Rovers will be at their stations in the spinning rooms. The factory is ordinarily staffed one Rover to a machine, but today, as for the last few days, the company is having to stretch its workforce to ensure every machine is adequately manned. A woman named Nellie Kershaw, employed at Turner and Newell for more than 15 years, has been absent since the start of the week. She has taken to her bed, having suffered night sweats and a shortness of breath. At her side, listening intently through a stethoscope to the rise and fall of her laboured breaths, stands a local physician, Dr. Walter Joss. A former medieval market town that became a major hub of the British textile industry, Rochdale is now one of many historic English towns long since deindustrialised. During the peak years of the Industrial Revolution, its famously wide canal was used to ferry wool, cotton, and coal produced across the country. One of the few remaining relics of that era is the Turner and Newell Asbestos Factory. Founded in 1871 by three brothers, John, Robert, and Samuel Turner, the company began as a manufacturer of cotton cloth-based packaging. Less than a decade after it was founded, Turner Brothers, as it was known then, began using heavy machinery to turn asbestos into cloth. The firm renamed itself the Turner Brothers Asbestos Company, changing its name once more to Turner and Newell after merging with a consortium before listing on the London Stock Exchange in 1920. By the 1970s, the firm produced enough asbestos cloth each year to span the UK from top to bottom twice over, and enough asbestos yarn to wrap around Earth more than 220 times. It even operated an asbestos mine in Swaziland from 1939 until 2001. By the end of the century, the firm had been acquired yet again, though soon after went into administration, taking with it a hefty backlog of asbestos litigation from former employees, including Swazi miners, all of whom had fallen ill as a result of exposure to asbestos. Kershaw was the first of Turner & Newell's employees to confront the firm over its management of asbestos in the workplace, but unlike the lawsuits that would haunt the firm years later, Kershaw's fight for vindication proved relentlessly uphill. Dr. Joss had diagnosed Kershaw's condition in 1922 as asbestos poisoning. As far as he was concerned, the cause of Kershaw's symptoms were clear. Since the age of 12, she had worked long hours handling large bundles of friable asbestos fibre, throughout which time Turner & Newell had not provided her with any form of guard against inhaling what Joss knew, from his experience examining other asbestos workers, to be highly hazardous clouds of fibre dust. But because asbestos poisoning wasn't yet recognised as an occupational illness, Kershaw found she was ineligible to receive sickness benefits via national health insurance. She was advised instead to seek compensation from her employer. Kershaw wrote to Turner & Newell, making her case to the company and citing the Workmen's Compensation Act. On receipt, the company balked, ordering its insurance firm to reject the claim. It correctly foresaw that Kershaw's letter set a dangerous precedent. The important thing now was to ensure Joss's diagnosis would be invalidated, were it ever to be presented before a court. Under the scrutiny of barristers paid handsomely by Turner and Newell to undermine his expertise, Joss calmly delivered his argument before the judges. The company maintained that it could not be held responsible because there was no evidence, they claimed, that asbestos was in fact poisonous. Before the court could come to a judgment, Kershaw passed away on the morning of the 14th of March 1924, aged 33. She'd received no payment from either the state or Turner and Newell, and left behind her husband, Frank, and at least one child. Joss's diagnostic report eventually found its way into the hands of a highly respected pathologist by the name of William Cook. Cook reviewed the literature, along with copious records Joss kept of cases similar to Kershaw's. His mind was made up when a coroner's examination found tiny fibres, some nearly half a millimetre in length, buried deep in Kershaw's lung. Taking all this evidence together, the cause of her death now lay beyond reasonable doubt. Her death certificate would later describe fibrosis of the lungs due to the inhalation of mineral particles. Kershaw was given an unmarked pauper's grave in Rochdale Cemetery, which remains there to this day. Her death was the first to expose a culture of ignorance, and in many cases secrecy, around asbestos throughout the 20th century. As explained in Part 1, the asbestos boom during this period brought three types of asbestos to the UK: white, brown, and blue. Blue asbestos, known as chrysidolite, by far the most toxic, was used in the filters of gas masks. It was later used again in the Second World War to make basic shelter equipment, uniforms, protection gear, and military vehicles, finding its way into virtually all branches of the British and US military. A US military poster from 1942 depicts a perplexed Hitler, flanked by Mussolini and Tojo, sitting atop a pile of loot from invaded lands. "What? No asbestos?" it reads, before explaining, "Not a single ton of asbestos suitable for war purposes is produced in Germany, Italy, and Japan, nor is any produced in any of the countries that have been overrun. And asbestos is vital in this war, in tanks and trucks, ships and planes." This heavy use of asbestos during both world wars would eventually lay claim to the lives of many veterans, and subsequently many others who fell ill after conflicts that followed. According to Mesothelioma UK, a charitable organisation that has supported victims of the disease since 2004, around 8 British veterans claim compensation every month as a result of receiving diagnosis. In the United States, around 30% of mesothelioma victims are military veterans. Let's go back a moment to that word, mesothelioma. First coined by British pathologist J.G. Adami in 1909, the term wasn't used to diagnose asbestos-related illness until the 1940s. Since then, however, it has remained the most common form of asbestos-related disease and has the most direct causal links to asbestos dust. It develops through much the same process as asbestosis, described in Part 1, by serrating the lung tissue and eroding the air sacs. Mesothelioma creeps up stealthily, taking between 20 to 50 years to manifest as symptoms. Once diagnosed, it is incurable. Much as Nellie Kershaw's story demonstrates, asbestos didn't just threaten people's health throughout the 20th century, but also the prestige and wealth of major corporations. Men like Walter Joss would continue to make worrying discoveries about its effects and would continue to face heavy resistance. Dr. W.C. Huper, an occupational physician employed by the United States National Cancer Institute, was one of the first US doctors to warn of the cancer risks asbestos posed the general US population. His claims were backed up by more than 200 references in the widely available literature regarding asbestos and its associated illnesses. In 1950, Huper tried to publish a 20-page pamphlet on environmental cancers based on this evidence. Under pressure from industry leaders, among which was one of Huper's former employers, the chemical giant DuPont, the National Cancer Institute stopped the pamphlet from reaching print. So the myth of the magic mineral continued. From the end of the Second World War onwards, television adverts on both sides of the Atlantic featured household products containing asbestos designed for everyday use.
Industry finds wide uses for asbestos in the construction of its buildings,
just as the farmer and homeowner do. So do schools, hospitals, and public buildings. And not only outside, but inside as well. Asbestos helps beautify the home with colorful vinyl asbestos floor tile. Tough asbestos fiber protects them against wear. In the cords of household appliances that demand heavy amounts of electricity, asbestos provides protective insulation. And no matter how long little Johnny plays with his electric train, asbestos insulation in the transformer offers similar protection.
The US is arguably the only advanced country not to have completely banned asbestos. In 1989, a ruling to prohibit the use of asbestos was issued by the Environmental Protection Agency, only to be overturned in 1991 after the asbestos industry exerted pressure to maintain the status quo. Here's one former American real estate developer testifying before Congress in 2005, claiming that the harms around asbestos are exaggerated and advocating its use in public buildings.
In New York City, we have a lot of asbestos buildings, and there's a whole debate about asbestos. I mean, a lot of people could say that if the World Trade Center had asbestos, it wouldn't have burned down, it wouldn't have melted, okay? A lot of people think asbestos, a lot of people in my industry think asbestos is the greatest fireproofing material ever made. But in your great wisdom, you folks have said asbestos is a horrible material, so it has to be removed.
The ban on asbestos in Western Europe was neither instantaneous nor fully coordinated. By the mid-80s, UK industries could no longer avoid the fact of its disastrous impact on the health of tradesmen, such as joiners, carpenters, and electricians. From around the late 70s, the media had begun probing deeper into the nature of asbestos fibres, how they can be released through simple wear and tear of seemingly harmless objects, posing an invisible danger to consumers, who quickly avoided buying anything containing the material. This was a period in which, as you may recall from part one, the UK shipped in close to 200,000 tons of asbestos each year. Yet the argument from science was finally starting to break through the noise. Julian Pato, a statistician and cancer epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, who we'll meet again in part three, explains how the ban in 1999 took place piecemeal, slowly choking off the industry over the course of two decades until, through a directive adopted by the European Commission, it ceased production altogether in the UK and other EU member states.
Asbestos was actually banned in 1999 in the EU, but it was effectively banned in England virtually by 1980. Chrysidolite was so obviously incredibly dangerous that it was a voluntary ban actually by the industry. They never actually bothered to impose a ban. Britain just stopped using it in 1970. Amasite, brown asbestos, went on being used. I mean, the Health and Safety Executive introduced slightly more stringent regulations for amosite than for chrysotile, for white asbestos, which was a complete underreaction because, in fact, it was completely clear that cancer risks were much higher with brown asbestos. But the industry, while ferociously claiming that it was unfair, was surreptitiously stopping using it. So by 1980, there was no amosite being used at all. And that was the industry knowing perfectly well how dangerous it was while they pretended they didn't.
We began part one of Dust to Dust with the ban, and ended by asking how much of a difference this really made. We spoke about the 6 million tons of asbestos the UK now holds onto as a result of its 100-year glut, the number of people recorded dead each year in the UK as a result of asbestos-related illness, and the continuation of our ignorance of its threat to public health, which, as we shall learn in part three, has moved from traditional trade-based occupations to occupations such as teaching and nursing. The UK's Health and Safety Executive, HSE, predicts mesothelioma deaths will fall dramatically after 2020, basing its projection on former occupations, which faded with the industry. But this picks up nothing of the fact that 80% of British schools contain asbestos, as do 94% of NHS trusts. Behind this facade of decline, a slow rise in the number of deaths among teachers and nurses is beginning to emerge, along with the names and testimonies of teachers and nurses whose lives have suddenly been shortened through exposure to asbestos at work. Sandra Kellett, a former NHS nurse with mesothelioma and only 6 months to live, tells her story next time.
I wouldn't like anybody else to go through what me and my family are going through now, because I'm not ready to leave everybody, but it's something I'm having to face up to. I mean, I'm probably the tip of the iceberg. Unless they're going to do something about getting the asbestos removed, then, you know, there's going to be thousands and thousands